Remember when you were
18?
There was this guy
in a long-haired rock and roll band.
Your mother didn't understand.
She asked me why the singer's name was Alice.
You knew why.
Well, we got no class, and we got no principle.
He set you free. Happened to Alice? Find out Saturday night on Shay. You remember Alice?
Hello! Hooray! Let the show begin. I've been ready.
Sure, you remember?
Welcome to my.
He seemed so sure of himself, like he would never go away.
Welcome to my breakdown.
So whatever happened to Alice? Find out after this. Okay, are you ready? So let's find out. Whatever happened to Alice? Is that it over there? Alice? Alice, is that you?
Crazy.
Tell us, Alice. What's happened?
I think I finally found an audience that understands me.
Okay, so he's back. Now, where's he been?
I was gone for.
To debate the sanity of patient number 1111, also known as Alice Cooper. The events of this case are bizarre. Frankly, I'm baffled. So I will show them to you for your judgment.
Let's begin at the beginning. Jimmy.
It's the mid-1960s, Phoenix, Arizona, and Vincent Damon Fernier, a minister's son, gets together with his high school buddies, Michael Bruce, Dennis Dunaway, Neil Smith, and Glenn Buxton, to perform at a Letterman's Club talent show. They took Beatles tunes and changed the lyrics as a joke. The idea of the band stuck, and they selected names that maintained the Beatles-like insect connection. The Earwigs, the Spiders, which of course was a hint of Black Widows to come. They were, for the most part, an English mod band in Carnaby clothes, and in Phoenix they were going nowhere fast. Something radical was needed. In 1967, they decided that shock rock was the ticket, and that they should take it to the capital of excess, Los Angeles.
You know, we were going to Los Angeles, and we were going to be in competition with the Doors and people like that. And I was just sitting there in the kitchen, you know, and I said, we got to come up with a name that's going to totally astound everybody. It's going to have to be a name that when people see us, it just doesn't match, or it's going to really outrage a lot of people. And I said, you know, it's got to be like, you know, we have all, everybody in the band's got hair down to their waist. I said, let's call ourselves, you know, Alice Cooper. I mean, I could have said Betty Thompson or anything, you know, but Alice Cooper was the first thing that came out of my head.
The late 60s in L.A. marked the pre-Woodstock peak of flower power, and an aggressively antagonistic band of transsexuals whose sole motivation seemed to be to upset their audience did not go over well. It became extremely hip to walk out on Alice Cooper, which made another LA musician sit up and take notice. Frank Zappa was amazed. By 1969, he had released two albums of Alice Cooper music on his Bizarre label, Pretty's for You and Easy Action.
Here's new pretties for you. No
Nobody likes me but me adore you. Da 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 da.
Time we were writing material that was so off the wall. I mean, Pretty's for You and Easy Action. Frank Zappa listened to it, you know, he listened to us play those songs live. And the arrangements on those songs are so unbelievably crazy. They don't follow any kind of musical sense at all because none of us were musically trained. So we wrote things that just sounded good to us. And, you know, the more erratic they were, the better. We found that if we could do 18 changes in 2 minutes, then that was like we were accomplishing something. So when he first heard us play and he heard us do these songs, he said, I don't even think I could teach the mothers those songs. He said, I don't even know how to write some of this music that you guys do. He said, how do you write that down on paper? And I said, I don't know. We don't write it on paper. We just play it. So, yeah, the first things that we did, you know, I mean, the first albums that we did were very odd. I don't know who they were directed at. They were probably just directed for us and then anybody that wanted to get involved in it.
From Pretty's for You, here's Titanic Overture, and from Easy Action, an excerpt from Beautiful Fly Away.
Me down to earth. Heavens are always been here. Let's have another nibble later. I think I'll disappear into the bishop's mirror and take a look at what we all fit.
DDT poisoning me, changing my relativity. What's it going to be?
And that's just what they did. Los Angeles turned off the group and vice versa. Another move was in order, and they took it. Finding that the best receptions on a cross-country tour had been in Detroit in 1971, they moved there and simultaneously made their first contact with Toronto record producer Bob Ezrin. It was a relationship that cannot be overstated that spanned a decade and 8 successful albums, including 8 hit singles.
Bob Ezrin was like, without him, there would have been no Alice Cooper. It would have been a very obscure Alice Cooper.
For most of the rock and roll youth of North America, their first taste of Alice Cooper came in 1971 with that first album that brought together Ezrin and Cooper, that stark black and white album, dark and foreboding. The strangest bunch of long hairs on the cover that disturbingly looked a lot more like drag queens than hippies or rock stars. When you opened up the gatefold cover, Alice's oversized painted eyes threatened to hypnotize, while the music pulsed with filmic terror.
Idea where they came from. I really don't. I don't sit back and try to analyze where they came from. They just sort of were like thoughts at the time. Dwight Fry, a song like Dwight Fry was dedicated to the character actor Dwight Fry, you know.
See my lonely life on the road. I see it every day. See my lonely, my next.
creepiest guy in any of the Dracula or Frankenstein movies was not Bela Lugosi or Boris Karloff. It was Dwight Fry, the little guy that, you know, ate the spiders and flies and stuff.
I want to get out of here.
Guitarist Michael Bruce emerged as a potent songwriter, and Bob Ezrin as a powerful manipulator of mood, dynamic, and texture. More importantly, where in the past the band had been introspective and self-involved, now they turned their energies to courting the only market that mattered.
Love to Death now is totally teenage-oriented.
And incidentally included one of the greatest rock anthems of all time. Love It to Death was just the beginning. The Alice Cooper machine had just started to really rock and roll. The music of Michael Bruce and Dennis Dunaway, the production of Toronto's Bob Ezrin, the words of Alice Cooper. 1971's Killers solidified their musical impact, while the press happily turned them into the nation's demonic darlings. Thus began the strange, schizophrenic relationship with the public that was to continue to this very day.
I'm a gambler, and I'm a runner. But you knew that when you laid down. I'm a picture of ugly stories. I'm a killer and I'm a clown.
Step into the street by sundown. Step into your last goodbye. You're a target just by living.
Songs like Dead Babies gave the kids the giggles and their parents the shakes. This was absurd horror movie excess performed as high camp glitter theater, and somehow the adults never got the joke. When incidents happened, they were blown out of proportion. When they didn't, they were fabricated.
Puppies being thrown from the stage? Never done that. I've never even killed a chicken on stage, which was the biggest rumor for years. They actually threw a chicken on stage. And it was in the middle of the last, I mean, it was the last song where we had feathers and CO2 cartridges and everything going like this. And somebody threw a chicken on stage. And, you know, I'm from Detroit. I figured that a chicken's got wings, it can fly, you know. And I just threw it back into the audience, and the audience tore it apart. And the next day in the paper, it was Alice Cooper tears head off chicken and drinks blood, you know. Horror, where a kid can't, you know, he can go out and buy a gun if you suggest a pistol on stage or a knife, but a kid can't go out and buy a guillotine. You know, we deal in total fantasy. We really don't deal in reality. My audience is smart enough to understand that.
More and more, that audience was clearly much younger than the 18 of their first hit single. And in 1972, they released the landmark album that aimed straight for the kids that were buying the albums.
Making all
A nod of the head must be given here to Alice Cooper's manager, Shep Gordon, who was the chief engineer of the vastly successful promotion campaign that so vitalized this period of the band's career. An example of his skill at generating publicity came with the packaging of the School's Out album. He'd become aware of an obscure section of American customs regulations that, for fire prevention reasons, would not allow the importation of paper underwear. So, he made plans to package the album with a pair of paper underwear on every sleeve, ordered the underwear from England, told the customs people he'd done it, reminded them that it was illegal, then called the press. As might be predicted, almost every radio station and newspaper was more than happy to run the wire service story about Alice Cooper's underwear being seized at customs. Ironically, Canadian customs does not have this regulation, and so many first buyers of schools out in Canada received their complimentary paper underwear. Out was also remarkable since, while it got the kids chanting in the schoolyard, it also got them listening to an amazingly diverse variety of every musical style in America, from blues to Broadway, adapted to the rock idiom and lushly orchestrated by Bob Ezrin. Here were clear clues to the American pop and vaudeville roots that were central to the early Alice Cooper phenomenon.
Whatever happened to Alice?
On Shea 106.
Still got a long way to go, long way to go.
Hello.
Hello.
Hooray. Welcome back.
Let the show begin. I've been ready.
For whatever happened to Alice?
Man, I laugh to myself at the man. $1 billion babies. La la da da da.
who would have conceived of these rock and roll terrorists so full of arrogance at their massive pop success that their 1973 album is packaged like a giant alligator skin wallet with a huge $1 billion bill inside. At some concerts, they actually threw real cash into the crowds. These were culture killers, going so far as to hire a person who was the living embodiment of peace, love, and anti-materialism to sing their anthem of capitalist greed. Here, in his duet with Alice Cooper, is Donovan Leitch. This was Alice at his most focused, visionary best. Nothing seemed impossible. Why not even public office? This album, this vision, were too strong. There was no way they could be followed up. Perhaps the rumors that Alice was getting tired of the blood and thunder were true. The stories about the exhausting billion-dollar baby tour and the toll it took on them all. Perhaps it was just the fact that Bob Ezrin wasn't available to produce the next album. Whatever the elements at work, 1974 marked a low point for the band. The album that failed to fulfill the promise of the rock juggernaut that was Alice Cooper was ironically titled Muscle of Love.
Well, I must have caught you there, crazy
With the exception of a few tracks, the consensus was that this muscle was limp. It was soon after the tour that accompanied this album that the band broke up. Ironically, on this tour, writer Bob Green was allowed to join the group as a minor performer in order to research a book about the rock and roll road. The result was the book Billion Dollar Baby, generally accepted to be one of the best accounts of rock touring in the annals of publishing, but also, incidentally, strongly denounced by its chief subject.
Project as an investigative reporter, and he also acted like an investigative reporter. Everything that was said, you know, on the tour, he wrote down as being a serious thought. That, you know, this guy had only been on the road for 2 weeks. We had been on the road for 10 years, so we understood road language. There was a point where I was drinking a lot. Everybody in the band was drinking a lot. We had been on the road a long time. I was, I had probably done 500 shows in a period of 2 years or something like that. And so, if the guy catches you in a bad mood and he suddenly makes it look like the band hated each other. When the band broke up, there was no animosity. There was no, boy, do I hate you for this and boy, do you hate me for that. There was none of that.
It was at this time that an amazing thing began to happen to Alice Cooper. The public started to become aware of several things. First, Alice Cooper was no longer the name of a band, but could refer only to its dynamic frontman. The other members of the group stayed together briefly as the Billion Dollar Babies, but soon went their own directions. Second, this frontman was a much more complicated person than they had been led to believe. Stories about him golfing with Bob Hope, hanging out with all manner of Tinseltown types. Jack Benny proclaimed him as, quote, more than just a rock star. Groucho Marx declared him, quote, the last hope for vaudeville. He appeared with Helen Hayes on an episode of the Sleuth Sisters. He appeared on Hollywood Squares and various talk shows. He became as well known as a beer-drinking patriotic television fanatic as a doll-destroying stage psychotic. Could the public handle so many changes of face? Though this new Alice may have been closer to his actual offstage persona, he now thinks it may not have been such a good idea to give it such exposure.
Well, the only thing about that is that it was kind of silly was the fact that it backfired. I thought that the audience was kind of tuned into my sense of humor. And the idea of Alice showing up on Hollywood Squares or showing up to play golf like that was because Alice didn't belong there. The last place Alice belonged was on Hollywood Squares, so I showed up. You know, it was an act of rebellion. It was an act of a lot of things. A lot of people then turned it around and said, well, that's what Alice wants to do. You know, and I just said, come on, everybody. You know, I said, this is funny. Don't you get it? I'm on Hollywood Squares. The lady that's winning the car won't even let her kid go to my concert.
What they did get was the slick new Alice that joined up with the old master Bob Ezrin and guitarist Dick Wagner to create one of the greatest concept albums and stage shows of all time, the classic Welcome to My Nightmare. Here was a perfect blending of every aspect of Cooper that the public knew. Dwight Frye had become the patently insane Stephen, whose twisted saga occupied most of Side 2. Ever popular necrophilia was represented in the person of Cold Ethel. The teen anthem was the rousing department of youth, and the camp horror theater of Black Widow and Devil's Food was hosted by none other than Vincent Price, tying it all firmly to the new Hollywood rumors of an articulate, likable Alice with friends in high places. And who else but Alice Cooper could have a hit feminist ballad called Only Women Bleed? Here's a brief trip through that singular nightmare.
Welcome to my nightmare. I think you're gonna like it. I think you're gonna feel you belong. A nocturnal vacation, unnecessary sedation. You wanna feel at home, 'cause you belong. Welcome to my
to my breakdown. I hope I didn't scare you. That's just the way we are when we come down. We sweat and laugh and scream here, 'cause life is just a dream here.
Unhampered by sentiment. If I may put forward a slice of personal philosophy, I feel that man has ruled this world as a stumbling, demented child king long enough. And as his empire crumbles, my precious Black Widow shall rise as his most fitting successor.
These words he speaks are true. We're all yeomanry stew. We don't pledge allegiance to the Black Widow.
Stop screaming.
Steven! Welcome to my breakdown.
The world had barely woken from the nightmare when Cooper had another trip prepared for them. Virtually the same team had assembled, featuring the likes of Tony Levin and John Tropia as session players, once again with Bob Ezrin, Dick Wagner, and Alice sharing the writing credits, and produced another album that might easily have been the soundtrack for a demented Broadway spectacular. Alice Cooper Goes to Hell. It's the kind of guilt-ridden confession only a minister's son could write. The liner notes introduce it like this.
Lay still, Stephen, and I'll tell you a bedtime story. It's a very special story that only special children will understand. It's a half-awake story, and it'd be better if you close your eyes. It's a story that takes place in a dream, like other nightmares you have known. It's a dream that Alice has dreamed. You can dream along with them. You can follow Alice down the staircase, deep down the stairs to the pit where he doesn't want to go, but he has to.
Yeah. reason why I should.
Well, I
never get away.
All right, so I made a few mistakes. But listen, for heaven's sake.
Watch your language, kid.
Okay, don't get hot.
Give the kid a break.
This was 1976 and disco was digging in, and though the album did have a sarcastic anti-disco song called You Gotta Dance that linked the disco phenomenon and demonic possession, it also had this infectious song. Alice Cooper Goes to Hell marked the end of another period in the ever-changing Alice Cooper saga. This would be the last of Bob Ezrin's large-scale concept projects with Alice. The following album, released in 1977, was scaled down and inconsistent.
Welcome to My Nightmare was a big gothic-sounding album. It was a very big it was almost a screenplay. I mean, you know, it sounded like a soundtrack to a movie or something. And then Go to Hell was the same kind of sound. We were doing really high conceptual kind of things then. And even Lace and Whiskey was a lot less conceptual. Muscle of Love was a lot less conceptual. They were more or less just a series of songs.
Also like Muscle of Love, Lace and Whiskey failed to maintain the force of its immediate precursors, despite some fine Cooper, Wagner, Ezrin compositions. If anything, the lyrics of Lace and Whiskey express a powerful frustration. There's even one song called I Never Wrote Those Songs. In King of the Silver Screen, Alice's long-harbored desire to be a movie star is explored. And in the album's hit single Ballad, the reality of his life off the stage seems to find voice.
Sometimes when you're asleep and I'm just staring at the ceiling, I wanna reach out and touch it. You just go on dreaming. If I could take you to heaven, that would make my day complete. You and me ain't no movie star. What we are is what we are. We share a bed.
But the real key to understanding the Alice of this period is the second half of that album title, for at this time, whiskey was taking its toll. And not long after the album's release, he would be institutionalized in an alcohol rehabilitation program in Los Angeles. During this period, he was contracted to perform in the Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band project and had to take a leave from therapy to complete the filming. His contribution was a disturbingly inappropriate version of Abbey Road's Here Comes the Sun King in what proved to be a chaotic and ill-conceived project, and it seems somehow symbolic that his Beatles-inspired career would lead him to this false and degrading surrogate for success while he was at his personal lowest point. But all was not totally bleak. This period also included marriage to Cheryl Goddard, whose father was also a minister, and his period of hospitalization left him with plenty of material for what proved to be his last concept album to date, 1978's From the Inside. Produced by Canadian David Foster and co-written with Foster, Dick Wagner, and Elton John's old songwriting buddy, Bernie Taupin, From the Inside chronicled his period of medical incarceration by profiling a variety of other characters also serving time in the same mental institution, among them a gambler, a Vietnam veteran, and interestingly, a minister.
I'm a ship for the Pentecost. I got my scriptures and my wires crossed. I got no kids and I got no home. They want us holy men to live alone. Since I've been here for a little stay, I see Rosetta a day by day. She turns my head, makes me cough. I wanna tear my collar off, and I just can't sleep at night. Rosetta dressed in white, she got the devil's light.
Admit that you're sick. Alice, tell me how it started. Think back. Way back.
Finally, the ballad of Dwight Fry had come home for Alice Cooper, and he could speak of the padded cell and the manic delusions with a little more than just a dreamer's experience.
Whatever happened to Alice?
Remember the coop, huh? I hope you don't forget me or nothing.
Whatever happened to Alice?
I still can't believe you never heard of Alice. I was Cooper. Don't you read t-shirts?
Alice Cooper, she's one of Charlie's Angels.
Alice Cooper is a he. And he has invited me to go to New York City because we're such good friends. Why, he's the first punk, sick and depraved and un-Christian. I just can't believe you never heard of him.
Now, Lola, it don't make no difference whether I ever heard of this Alice person or not. Because I ain't ever had a drink with a man, so it don't mean nothing.
1980 saw the second coming of Alice Cooper to the film screen, playing himself in the film Roadie, which also starred Meatloaf and featured Blondie, Asleep at the Wheel, and several other rock and country performers. The film was only moderately successful commercially, but spawned a sizable cult following and once again raised the question, whatever happened to Alice's film career? Meanwhile, 1980 also marked the beginning of yet another new phase in the seemingly inexhaustible musical shape-changing of Alice Cooper, with the new wave-directed Flush the Fashion. Many of the songs, co-written with Davy Johnstone and Fred Mandel from his touring band, are high-tension, up-tempo attempts at 80s new wave dance rockers. But the Cars-inspired Clones, written by David Caron, was the song that caught the public ear.
We're all clones.
all its moments of pleasure, Flush the Fashion is a failure, as is its follow-up Special Forces, which probably marks the lowest points in terms of production value of any of his works. Working again with his touring band of LA pickup musicians, he presented this bare, unattractive set of harsh rockers and toured it as guerrilla theater in small venues, milking militant vigilanteism for its entertainment value.
Who do you think we are?
Both tour and album of Special Forces failed to win any battles for our intrepid hero. In 1982 came the bizarre and intriguing Zipper Catches Skin, with a very inventive cover concept by Cooper and a set of interesting, well-written songs that drew from many corners of Cooper's creative repertoire. Yet again, the world of film is referred to. Alice's recording of a Lalo Schifrin song, I Am the Future, themed from the future punk movie Class of 84, is included. A song called I'm Alive sounds like it should be used in a Stephen King adaptation, and the song Tag You're It owes its inspiration directly to John Carpenter's horror classic Halloween.
I just like the scene in Halloween. You think it's all over, and you're gazing into space. But you've got to make sure you hear something, you start to turn, and you're standing there frozen, staring him face to face. And he looks at you and says, Tag, you're it, sweetie.
And then came Da Da. 1983's bizarrely titled album marked the brief reassociation of the master team of Bob Ezrin, Dick Wagner, and Alice that had worked such wonders on Nightmare and Goes to Hell. Though there is nothing in Da Da like those albums' unifying focus, it is an accomplished production with many potential classics.
I love my jeans and I love my hair. I love a real tight skirt and a real nice pair. And on the 4th of July, I love the rock of red glare. I watch the A-Team every Tuesday night. I graduated, but ain't too bright. I love Detroit, cause I was born to fight. Enough's 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 enough. This year's been really, really rough.
It's interesting to note, while contemplating Cooper's struggles to sustain his career through these years, some of the cumulative effect he has had on his contemporaries. The glitter rock of the 70s was arguably his invention. He wore makeup before Bowie or Jagger. Satirical theater rock such as the Tubes perform is strongly derivative of the Cooper act. Certainly heavy metal as we know it now would not have been the same without Alice Cooper. Kiss is the classic example. Dee Snider of Twisted Sister in particular pays total homage to the influence. But the effect is broader and has likely touched many more other mainstream areas. Much, for example, has been made of Michael Jackson's Thriller, rhyming the killer title and borrowing Welcome to My Nightmare's Vincent Price narration. One irony is in the fact that at the time of the original Alice Cooper breakup, some members of the band wanted to sound more like Pink Floyd. Years later, Bob Ezrin produced The Wall, and Pink Floyd ended up sounding like Alice Cooper. So what did happen to Alice? Certainly the much-expected film career never came to pass.
Probably get 5 movie scripts a week. It's just the fact that, I mean, I'm not a leading man at this point. I don't want to be a leading man. If I'm going to do anything in movies, it'll be more on splatter movies.
Speaking of splatter films, this is what happened to Alice after a 3-year absence from recording.
He's back, the man.
This is the theme from Friday the 13th, Part 6, and this song is one of the first volleys of yet another new, different attack from the master of masks, Alice Cooper. The album digs back for all the old symbols of Alice the depraved, Alice the insane. It's called Constrictor, and Cooper leers in strangled face makeup on the front, hangs from the neck dead on the back. But this is dark, distilled Alice. No ballads here, no lush orchestration from Bob Ezrin or David Foster. The album was produced by Bo Hill, producer of the modern mega metal band Rat. Co-writing is thrash guitarist Kane Roberts. This is quite simply heavy metal without tempering on its own terms. The irony is obvious. More than a decade ago, Cooper helped inspire a generation of teens with his subtly satirical leather-clad rock androgyny, hinting at absurd extremes of occultism, sex, and violence. for the most part, these were kids who either didn't see the joke or wanted to partake only in the intoxicating reality it represented. They grew up to create a hard, grim school of heavy metal that took itself very seriously indeed. Now at last, after wandering far from the vision of his youth, Cooper has returned, taken up the weaponry of his bastard offspring, and once again taken aim at the world.
I'm the kid on the block with my head made of rock, and I ain't got nobody. Give it up!
And how has the world responded?
Well, it's a funny note, because we're getting more reaction now than we ever have. We're getting more protest, more banning around the country, you know, or threats of banning. Every place, you know, I'd say every one out of every five shows is threatened by the city council, the police, the council of churches, and something like that. And it's usually over the most absurd things, but Alice is a real target again, and it's kind of refreshing. This Alice is about 10 times more powerful than the old one.
This Alice Cooper special was written and produced in the studios of Shea 106 by Jeff Green, with the special assistance of Jim Hergum.
Stranger Media. To find out more about the works of Jeff Green, go to strangermedia.com.